From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, who will protect pre-existing conditions? There's a lot of flip-flopping going on about pre-existing positions. The Trump administration is sending thousands of active military troops to the border. What does that mean for border residents? And what happened when an unusual number of Central American asylum seekers were suddenly released from detention? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With Election Day on Tuesday, November 6th, there is polling telling us that health care is an issue that many voters are caring about, particularly keeping the Obamacare protection for pre-existing condition. The issue has become so dominant in the minds of voters that President Donald Trump tweeted about it on October 18th, stating, "All Republicans support people with pre-existing conditions, and if they don't, they will. After I speak to them, I am in total support." But do the words match the action? There is doubt because of pre-existing positions and existing documentation that tell a different story. Sophie Novak is reporting on the issue for the Texas Observer.
It's been pretty remarkable. What we're seeing is that healthcare has come to play a really large role in the midterms coming up. We see in polling that it's a really important issue to folks. And specifically, we're seeing that people are really caring about making sure that their pre-existing conditions continue to be covered, that insurance companies can't charge more for them or can't deny people insurance because they have a pre-existing condition. And Democrats have kind of seized on that and made pre-existing conditions protections that exist through the Affordable Care Act really central to a lot of campaigns. And what we're seeing is, in response, a lot of Republicans basically saying, oh, well, we support protecting pre-existing conditions. We've always supported protecting pre-existing conditions. And that's just not true. If you look at their records, we see a lot of Republicans in Congress that have repeatedly voted against the Affordable Care Act without any kind of replacement. There's a Texas lawsuit right now led by Attorney General Ken Paxton that includes 19 other Republican attorneys general that's saying we should get rid of the entire Affordable Care Act, including the pre-existing conditions protections. And it's really, Republicans don't want to be saying that they don't support those protections. So instead, what it comes down to is lying about their record.
But are they saying now that they have seen the light? They've had a road to Damascus moment, and now they realize that this is actually a good thing and they want to protect it?
Not really. I haven't really seen candidates saying, I erred in the past and now I recognize this is important and here's a plan that actually would cover these conditions. What I've seen more is candidates saying, of course, we support this. Pointing to records that actually in fact show they haven't supported it. And so kind of trying to wipe away the actions that they've taken in the past that show that actually that's not true, while kind of continuing to say, yes, we do support it, without really having policies proposed or in place that would actually do that.
Are we talking about the same things when Democrats talk about protections for pre-existing conditions and Republicans, or are they talking about two different things?
The pre-existing condition protections that are in place now through the Affordable Care Act are really quite strong. So they say that insurance companies cannot deny people insurance coverage because they have a pre-existing condition, and they can't charge people more. And so something that we've seen from Republicans is Republican Pete Sessions, who's in a competitive race right now, proposed a resolution this summer that says, yes, we support pre-existing condition protections, but it's non-binding. It doesn't actually do anything to make sure that is true. We've also seen some Republican proposals that say, basically you protect pre-existing condition protections, but they actually would allow insurance companies to charge more for that coverage. And so there's a difference between, making sure that coverage is available and affordable versus making sure that it's kind of technically available, but could be, the folks could be completely priced out of it.
So there is this lawsuit that Attorney General Ken Paxton, who is running for re-election as a Republican right now, so this lawsuit is trying to overturn the entire Affordable Care Act, including pre-existing condition protections. And this was filed and with other states, other Republican attorneys general, and but this is being led by Texas?
That's right. It was filed in February. It includes 20 Republican states, but it is led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. And the lawsuit challenges the entirety of the Affordable Care Act. But I think part of what's really put a focus on pre-existing condition protections is that the Trump administration this spring actually came out and said, we're not going to defend this this law in court. Instead, we actually agree that pre-existing conditions protections specifically are unconstitutional and should be struck down. And so that's really where we see kind of the most hypocrisy now is President Trump continues to tweet, of course, we're going to protect pre-existing conditions protections. You know, Republicans support these, Democrats don't. And yet his administration is literally in court right now suing to try to get rid of those conditions, those protections.
So what would happen to the marketplace for health insurance if suddenly the pre-existing conditions protections were zapped by this lawsuit?
Yeah, so it's pretty straightforward for us to kind of look at what that would look like, because that's the situation that was in place before the Affordable Care Act was passed. What we saw in Texas before these protections were put into place by the Affordable Care Act is people with cancer, people with diabetes, people who were pregnant, people who could become pregnant, you know, all of those were considered pre-existing conditions and could be denied coverage in the insurance market. And so, for example, none of the insurance plans on Texas's individual market covered maternity care before these protections were put into place by the ACA. People that ended that had had cancer had a really hard time finding coverage, and it's really lots and lots of different conditions that could fall under that. And it meant that people could be priced out of coverage or be charged more because they were female, because they were older, because of prior health conditions, et cetera.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's running for re-election, he has been really loud and vocal in the past about how terrible the Affordable Care Act is. He even shut down the government over that. And now does he say that he is in favor of protecting pre-existing conditions?
He does. He actually said in a debate, I believe in both debates against his opponent, Beto O'Rourke, he said that everyone agrees we're going to protect pre-existing conditions. And as you said, that this is Senator Cruz who shut down the government over defunding the Affordable Care Act, including those protections. He has proposed amendments that would weaken, allow states to kind of weaken those protections. And he actually has voiced support for Attorney General Paxton's lawsuit that would eliminate those protections. And so I asked Senator Ted Cruz's office, you know, how to kind of reconcile those what seem to be very differing opinions, how he would actually protect pre-existing conditions, and did not get a response on that specifically.
But we hear people like Ted Cruz say things like, "We want healthcare freedom." How does that square with protecting pre-existing conditions?
Yeah, that's something that you hear a lot from folks that are that have opposed the Affordable Care Act, is things like, you know, we want state sovereignty, we want freedom of choice, et cetera. But what you're looking at really is the scenario that I described beforehand in the individual market. We know what that looked like in Texas. And, you know, it meant that these folks that had these pre-existing conditions really were not protected.
Sophie Novak is a staff writer for the Texas Observer. She is reporting on the issue of support for the protections of pre-existing conditions for health insurance. Operation Faithful Patriot is the name of the Department of Defense mission that is sending thousands of active duty military personnel to the U.S.-Mexico border. This is the largest deployment of military might to the southern border since before World War I. The Pentagon says more than 7,000 troops are being sent. Some are there now, and more are arriving. President Donald Trump says the number could reach 15,000. Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute.
Well, what's changing is this is the first time we've had active duty soldiers deployed. Typically in the past, it's always been National Guard, Reserve soldiers that have been deployed. And this is definitely the most soldiers we've had deployed. I mean, initially it's 5,200, but the White House is saying it could be up to 15,000 soldiers. I think we had a deployment of 6,000 National Guard under George W. Bush in 2006. So if we go above 5,200, then this would be the largest deployment we've seen. The military is also monitoring the progress of the caravans, and there's also a ton of reporters down there reporting on the caravans as they progress north. And in fact, they've already lost quite a few people from the first caravan that, you know, was around 7,000 at first. It's now down to something like 3,000, and it's still in the state of Oaxaca, so it's still 1,000 miles away from the border.
But is the caravan a conventional military threat to the United States?
No, it's not a threat at all. I mean, there's already such a significant buildup of federal agents, local police, National Guard at the border that they can totally handle. The last time a caravan came through in the spring, when President Trump was alarmed about that caravan, it ended up being about between 200 and 400 people that arrived at the California border requesting asylum. The system that's in place can handle processing these people that are coming.
How does this impact the people who are on the Texas side of the border?
Well, I mean, that's what I've been documenting for many years. How do these deployments affect the American communities that are absorbing all of this militarization, especially in the Rio Grande Valley from, Mission down to Brownsville in that area, which has received a lot of these deployments over the years. And I'm talking both from state police, DPS, which had an unprecedented surge, they called it, of sending, DPS agents from all over the state down to that area of the border. And then we've also had National Guard there for years as well. And, by my count, including this deployment, I think we're up to 12 in the last decade of soldiers and also state police being sent down to guard the border.
What have we gotten for that?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of critics, including, people in Congress, people in the Texas legislature. Texas spent in the last decade close to $2 billion on border security. And the question is, on what are we getting our money's worth? What exactly has that all that expenditure and having all of these boots on the ground down there gotten us? And the numbers have also been criticized that have come from DPS and from the federal government as to whether this money is even effectively being spent. And usually they focus on number of apprehensions. And some of the numbers I've seen with these National Guard deployments is they're spending about $6,000 per apprehension of people coming across. And we also have to say that these people who are coming across, and the Rio Grande Valley has the highest number along the border right now, people coming across, they're presenting themselves to the agents and asking for asylum. They're not coming under the cover of night and in a covert type of way. They're actually wanting to get caught. I don't think the military wants to be in this role, honestly. But it does really hurt American communities economically along the border when these deployments happen, because the rest of the country and the world gets a sense that it's an unsafe place, and they don't want to go there, so, and they don't want to spend their money there. And so it's hurting these communities hugely, and it's also really affecting their freedom and their liberty when they drive around, or when they want to go walk in a park or something, especially along the river now, where a lot of the soldiers will be deployed and where there's already a very heavy security presence.
Melissa DeBosque is an investigative reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. She is also the author of the book Bloodlines. Last weekend at U.S. immigration detention centers and Border Patrol holding facilities, there was an unusual high number of Central American asylum seekers released. Many of them were dropped off at bus stations in South Texas, where they were met by local faith-based nonprofits who were put to the test to provide assistance. Texas Public Radio commentator Yvette Benavides was there, and she has these observations.
When I was a young mother, whenever my daughter was about to confront an unfamiliar situation, my strategy to allay her anxiety was to describe what to expect. Now, when we go into the theater, it will be really dark, I'd say, by way of preparing her, and the movie will be really, really loud. We do this as parents. We try to soothe our children's apprehension of what is scary for being strange and new. Imagine a parent saying to a child, "Now when we get there, the man in the dark green uniform is going to put you in a large room with 200 other children. There will be no furniture, no chairs to sit in to rest, no beds to sleep in. There won't even be blankets, only some sheets that look like aluminum foil for you to cover yourself up with when you lie on the floor at night. Other children will be in the room with you, and there will be so many that you will have to lie down right next to them. And if you feel like crying, there will be no privacy for you to do that, and everyone will hear your sobs and see your tears. Be sure to eat the bread and drink the water that they give you, because that is all there will be for you by way of nourishment. I'll be in another room with the other mommies. We will cry too. I will be able to hear your screams when the man in the uniform separates us." Imagine knowing that's the script and making the decision just the same to make the journey to a new, strange, sometimes inhospitable country. This is what happened to Bertalina, a single mother who escaped the violence of her hometown of Santa Rita Copan in Honduras, when she brought her little boy some 1,500 miles by land and river to surrender to the Border Patrol in the Rio Grande Valley and end up separated from her son in the Hieleras, the freezing cold holding cells with zero amenities, for 5 days. Bertalina is part of a mass release this month of immigrants from these holding cells and from detention centers, two in Texas and one in Pennsylvania. She refers to the cell as a perrera, a dog kennel, where she and 200 other women stood or lay on the cold floor, elbow to elbow, with only meager rations of bread and water twice a day. I met Bertalina earlier this week when she arrived at the Greyhound bus station in San Antonio at 3 a.m. In the overnight hours, the station is kept uncomfortably cold, perhaps to keep people from settling in and spending the night. Her son, who looked to be about 8 years old, had a lung-tearing cough that came intermittently, unbidden, ripping and uncontrollable. She said the cough started after their time in the Hieleras. She described hearing his screams when the two were separated and put in different holding cells. Now together, they wait for their 6 a.m. bus and their ultimate destination of Los Angeles, where their relatives live. Next week, Bertalina will go to immigration court and will be fitted with a large, bulky ankle bracelet to monitor her movement. Earlier at the bus station, a group of 30 migrants just released from holding cells and detention centers in Dilley and Karnes County waited for their bus to Dallas and transfers to cities all over the country. An impatient toddler pulled on his mother's arm, knocking over the suitcase with a Buzz Lightyear doll hanging off the handle. The boy's novelty t-shirt said, "Ladies, I have arrived." Perhaps that incongruous decal would elicit laughs in another context. Here, it was somehow poignant. Eye level with the Buzz Lightyear doll on the carry-on, he pushed his face against the toy and said, "Pshoo, pshoo," raising his arms out a la Buzz. Minutes later, their bus called on the loudspeaker. The mother pulled on the suitcase and shuffled to the place in another queue. The boy held Buzz Lightyear's hand and fidgeted in place. Around mid-morning the next day, the Interfaith Welcome Coalition was set up, ready to face throngs of families being released on the border. This week, they're seeing twice as many families on any given day. Why now? It's a confusing motive some believe is part of the Trump administration's creation of optics to help generate midterm anxiety for potential Republican voters. Some think that releases will make room for the migrants coming from Central America. According to a statement from ICE, the releases are part of their efforts to hold to their own imposed limits and laws regarding the number of people they can reasonably accommodate. Sister Denise LaRocque, bus station coordinator of the Interfaith Welcome Coalition in San Antonio, doesn't know the real reason, and for her, it is beside the point. The only reality for her is that the families arriving at the bus station need help. The coalition offers snacks and toiletries. They help interpret the English on the bus tickets to the newly arrived about to depart again for parts north. On this day, the team of volunteers sets about to review tickets of those on the latest bus to arrive, all women and children from the detention center in Dilley, Texas. Those with connecting buses leaving immediately are sent to the front of the line, perhaps the only time these families have ever been at the front of any line, literally or figuratively. Those with longer layovers line up in another part of the bus station where volunteers announce that they will be escorted to the Travis Park Methodist Church where they can momentarily escape the cold bus station, the noise and chaos, the unpleasant smells of institutional cleaning product mingled with exhaust and the funkiness of a well-used transit station. The families from this bus wear just issued sweatshirts and jeans and tennis shoes. One family has on red shirts and blue shoes, one family green shirts and red shoes. No color means any one thing, but members of each family wear the same colors. A closer look reveals that each person has used an intricate and elaborate way to lace up the tennis shoes. These look like loomed or knitted works of art. Even in a nondescript institutional-looking uniform, each person clings to a specialness and individuality in this small way. The children smile shyly, babies and boys and girls ranging in age from several months to perhaps 8 and 9 years old. The older adolescent kids seem suitably stony-faced, with only a little bit of weary fear showing through. They're far outnumbered by infants and toddlers, the tender-aged. One repeatedly remarkable action occurred among the children. Many tried to engage the volunteers. The littlest ones looked up from their crawling or toddling with no guile whatsoever and smiled. The ones about 5 or 6 and older were more guarded in their investigation. One held up a small star toy, his mouth just a resolute line, but he wanted me to see him and react. "Me gusta tu estrella," I said. He pulled his arm down, the star in his hand now hidden behind his back, and only his face now looking up at me as if trying to gauge our acceptance of him in this strange new place. One boy of about 5 or 6 complains about the weight of his bag as we make our way to the church. His mother silently pulls the bag from him and adds it to her load. When we arrive at the steps of the church, Sister Constanza, a new arrival from Mexico herself, tells the group to brace themselves. It will be cold inside the church, she says. She hugs herself and goes, "Brr," the mime meant to show the children what to expect. It's another motherly warning of what to anticipate to make the unexpected and unfamiliar easier to bear. A few mothers squint up at the sun warming the group. But when we walk the short hallway and enter the playroom, no one notices anything, distracted instead by the magical ways of the children, once quiet and clinging to their mothers, come alive, move away from them, start laughing, talking to each other, pulling toys off the shelves, hugging dolls and teddy bears, building towers of blocks, connecting magnetic train cars together, and making those universal choo-choo sounds for trains, or room-room for cars, or pshoo-pshoo for tiny rockets. The other volunteers continued the work of translating the information on the bus tickets for the women, but among this particular group of volunteers, only Sister Constanza spoke Spanish and asked for my help to translate. and neither one of us could translate much for the women who didn't speak Spanish, but only one of the five indigenous languages still spoken in Honduras. When a volunteer received a phone call from a sponsoring family in California, I was asked to translate. Although the connection was bad, I found myself trying to find clues in the man's voice and even in the silence about him and this member of his family standing next to me. I let him know that her bus would arrive in their city the following day and gave him the time listed on her ticket. As we said goodbye, he prolonged the chat, thanking me profusely, wishing God's blessings on me and my family, earnestly grateful for the smallest act of help for his relative. I handed the phone to her, and she smiled so big for the first time in the last couple of hours. A volunteer announced that lunch would be served soon for the rest of the group and let everyone know where the water fountain and restrooms could be found in the church. Suddenly, a boy jumped up from his plane with the train set on the floor and offered proudly, "Yo tengo un pañal." It was a curious admission from a boy of about 4, obviously potty trained and too old to wear a diaper, but it occurred to me that the Pamper or Love's disposable diaper would have been a luxury item in his pueblito, and it was likely his mother had him wear one because of the long journey ahead. I also noticed the skinny boy had on 4 t-shirts, this layering again evidence of the mother's planning for the unexpected. Called to translate the tickets for more of the mothers, I spied one sitting in a corner of the room. She was young. Like all the other women, she wore the sweatshirt uniform. Conspicuously absent from her and all the women was the presence of any kind of jewelry, even costume jewelry. No earrings, no rings, no wedding bands or necklaces. No one wore any flourishes, save for a bracelet of yarn or string, a colorful scrunchie to hold a ponytail. When I approached, this mother tried to dissemble the fact that she was crying. ¿Qué le pasa? I asked. No, nada, nada, she insisted. After some prodding, she finally nodded toward the middle of the room. Mi niña, she said. In Spanish, she added, look at how skinny she is. She hasn't eaten in 4 days. I looked across the room at the girl, about 4 or 5 years old. Thin and pale she was, assuredly. At least she's smiling now, added the mother at the sight of the girl playing with a small doll. A volunteer leapt to her feet and escorted the two to the lunchroom. She said she would see about supplementing the meal with a nutritional drink. Surely now her appetite is back, we said, smoothing the weeping mother's shoulder, patting her arm, and leading her out into the hallway. Maybe this will become part of the parents' narrative to their children about what to expect once they cross the border. Maybe they will add to the script, telling their children that there are people on the other side of the river who really care about them. Before I left the playroom, I noticed that all the mothers sat together on the floor, resting their heads against the wall, closing their eyes for a few minutes. Here they were in another large room to hold them all in. But this time, they're all together, mothers and children. While they wait for the next bus that will carry them to another city, they will eat a real meal. The children will watch a Disney cartoon. The room's not too cold. No one minds that there are no chairs to sit in. There is no crying. There's only the sound of children comforting smiling dolls and chubby bears, pushing trains along invisible tracks, winning all the races, stretching arms up toward the sky, guiding the rockets to infinity and beyond.
Yvette Benavides is a Texas Public Radio commentator and a professor of creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. Yeah.